Okay, good morning, everyone. It is Thursday, March 14th, 10 a.m., and this is Henry Harris, and we're starting another installment of the weekly Emunah Teleform. Today's topic is codependence, the exciting experience of sensing and feeling that you're dependent on someone else's actions in order for you to have your well-being and equilibrium in a relationship, and the potential for that to make life feel very complicated. And first, we introduce with a simple review, an overview of what this call is about, which is the psychological implications of Emunah, the psychological implications of understanding that there is a single, simple truth behind all reality, behind all experience. And how does that work? It means to say that we are, the Jewish concept of Ein Od Milvado, of the notion that there is really nothing other than God, there is nothing other than the divine. Everything is simply an expression of and being energized at all times by divine energy, by the will of the divine source behind all life, moment to moment to moment. And that means to say that even though we're living in a world where we have the opportunity to make choices and experience circumstances and events and interactions, our capacity to have an actual experience of those events and interactions, the experience itself is occurring in our consciousness through the gift of divine energy, and that's actually what I'm directly experiencing, and that simplifies our lives. It's true, and it simplifies our lives in the sense that without that understanding, my experience is bopping all over the place. So my mood is going up, my mood is going down. I'm becoming bothered, I'm becoming relieved, and it can look and feel to me that it is a function of a whole variety of reasons and sources. Like, my children are fighting and I'm bothered. My children are not fighting and I'm now calm. My neighbor is giving me a hard time and I'm bothered, etc. Like, there's so many things that could be unfolding that seemingly are acting upon my experience of life. Right? There's so many sources of power, so many influences to account for that could lead me innocently to just relate to the idea that, like, okay, I want to avoid some things, I want to pursue some things, I want to manage and try and change some things, and I, you know, it becomes a very complicated world to the extent that it looks and feels to me that there are real things to account for of a variety of all kinds in terms of how my life experience is being touched and shaped. But with the understanding that there really is a single simple truth, a single simple cause behind all experience, behind everything, including even my capacity to have an experience of something, well, that definitely simplifies things. And it doesn't mean that I'm not going to be subject to agitated feelings or insecure experiences or upset. It doesn't mean that. It certainly is the case that we're going to experience all kinds of thought, all kinds of divine energy, because the Almighty has promised us that He is making available to us different states of mind, different modes of thought, right? The same way that the heart is pumping through us in a way that we're not controlling, and it's pumping both blood that's oxygenated and healthy, it's also pumping blood that's filled with toxins. And that's not a problem. It's not something that I'm controlling. It's not something I'm managing. It's part of the design of the human system that I flow with those two distinct types of flow. And that's a metaphor for our spiritual heart. The same way that the Almighty pumps my physical heart, I'm not pumping my heart. I'm benefiting from the pumping of my heart. I'm experiencing the real effect of the heart pumping blood, because otherwise my 50 trillion cells would conk out, God forbid, right? So I'm definitely experiencing the real effect of this flow of blood through my entire experience. I'm not managing it. I'm not controlling it. I'm not causing it. I don't really have direct control over it. So too, my spiritual heart is being pumped at all times by this divine source, and it's flowing with this oxygenated, highly peaceful state, flow of thinking and understanding, an understanding of truth. And it's also flowing with a misunderstanding, with what looks and feels to be an insecure experience of life, a world that is just, it's a divine energy that's agitated or insecure in some fashion. And I'm not causing that. I'm not the source of that. The divine source is the source of that. And that's what accounts for my experience. So what we're pointing to is not the idea of how to avoid having insecure feelings or insecure thoughts. We're looking to understand the truth about our experience and the simplicity behind it. And understanding that simple truth is going to go a long way. And the wonderful news further is that this is not an intellectual understanding. This is not an understanding that you can apply yourself to and grasp with hard work or with cleverness or with all kinds of strategy. It's not. It's the good news, though, is that you and I are designed with simplicity. We were made simple by the very creator that is running this simple world. That same creator created us with simplicity. There is a deep, unchanging nature to us that is simple, that therefore resonates with that simplicity. It's beyond our personal mind. It's beyond our capacity to know and understand with our analytical mind. It's a simple knowing that resides within us because we are ourselves, by nature, are simple. So it's wonderful news that this simple truth is something that we can grasp, we can tune into, we can resonate with, simply by acknowledging the truth. And simply by acknowledging the nature of what cannot be true, that points us in the direction of the simple truth, and it awakens that simple truth within us. And simply becoming more sensitive to, more open to that simple truth, that's the direction that we're looking in. And I think that's what everyone who's tuning into this conversation is acknowledging, is that we are designed to tune into this simple truth. And it's kind of almost like, you know, at least my experience is that the truth is working whether I acknowledge the truth and see the truth or not. I mean, it looks to me at times that it's not the case that there's a single simple truth. It looks to me at times like there's real exceptions to this rule, that there are real things in the world, real circumstances that are actually powerful over my state of mind, over my psychological experience. That's how it looks to me at times. Now, the good news is that I can know something about that even as I'm encountering it. And that's truth. That's the truth, and the truth is precious whether I feel enlightened or peaceful or I don't. I can know the truth about my experience at all times. And that's kind of the goal of this conversation, is to help us to see that truth, to see the simplicity of that truth, to see where that truth is showing up in our lives, and to be willing and able to acknowledge where my conclusions about my experience cannot be true. The human capacity to kind of get fooled by the idea that there's outside-in powers. So that's kind of the overview of this conversation once again. And today I wanted to talk about the phenomenon of codependence, which is just simply another word for outside in. It's the perception that it's kind of associated with relationships, you know, where let's say a spouse to a married couple get into protracted tussles or conflicts. Or a parent and a child can experience that. There's room for codependence in so many places, in work environments, in family environments. And the basic idea of codependence is just very simply put, the perception that I need, for my well-being, for my basic kind of equilibrium, I need my partner or the person that I'm in a relationship with, I need him to do or think certain things and to not do and not think certain things. And I think that's really what is going on in the phenomenon of all strained relationships, where we experience judgment, judgmental feelings, where we experience acrimony and lack of compassion. Well, lack of compassion makes a lot of sense. I mean, think about it for a second. Lack of compassion makes a lot of sense if you're in a relationship with someone who is consistently withholding something that you need. You need something. It's an absolute need as far as you're concerned. This person has the ability to provide that need, and the person is withholding that need. Now, that's a quote-unquote damage. You know, that's a form of, it almost feels like a form of damage, almost like a form of abuse. And inside of the logic of, I need this, I absolutely need this for this person in order for my equilibrium to be settled, then it makes a lot of sense to not have compassion, to feel judgmental and resentful toward another person. Now, of course, God forbid, I'm not suggesting that there's no such thing as inappropriate behaviors. I'm not suggesting that there isn't such a thing as actually damaging and abusive behaviors. I'm just simply pointing to the idea that where we want, it's going to be helpful to us to understand the truth about our experience in a given relationship in order to be able to take another step. So if I have a parent-child relationship, as I've discussed many times, and I feel that I feel damaged by, let's say, a child's lack of fulfillment of certain responsibilities. Let's say he's not fulfilling responsibilities in his school environment. Let's say he's not fulfilling responsibilities in his home environment. Let's say he's not acting toward me in a respectful way. It can look and feel to me that my equilibrium is being trashed by his behavior or his withholding of certain behaviors, right? It does look like that way to me at times. Or alternatively, between a husband and a wife, a husband has certain expectations about how he wants the home to run, and the wife just doesn't see those things in the same way. It doesn't occur to her to want to manage the home in the same way, and it's not that she's looking to to disrespect her husband or to disregard her husband. She doesn't see the world the way he sees the world, and now he's experiencing this letdown. Like, how many times have I asked you to do this or to not do this, and I don't get why you're not able to be responsive to my requests? So, of course, his feeling in that moment, potentially, not always, but potentially, to the extent that he really believes that he needs the home to go a certain way, or the child, you know, the discipline kind of parenting experience to go a certain way, and it looks and feels like that is safety, you know, almost like it's like terribly problematic not to have the home run a certain way or not to parent a certain way, and the other spouse just doesn't see that. So let's say it's the husband who's this case, you know, because that's how it can look in my home, right? The husband has certain preferences, let's just say, you know, strong preferences, and it looks really upsetting when those preferences aren't met. So I can express this, like, this sense of upset, of like, you're harming me, you know, you're inconsiderate, you're harming me, and you're not willing to acknowledge how you're harming me. And I resent you. Now, the logic of that resentment is built on the idea of an outside-in understanding. I feel a certain internal experience of discomfort. I look around and I think to myself, well, where else would that discomfort be coming from except the fact that the home is not orderly in a certain way, or that my discomfort, I'm looking around, where's my discomfort coming from? Oh, it's because the children are, there's permissiveness with the children that I feel is a violation of my values. I'm obviously discomforted by the lack of those things, right? It's not just their values, they're literally my equilibrium. So I feel that somebody is damaging me. And I don't get why they can't see what is obvious to me, that these are real things that are needed, and they're not only needed, they're part of my equilibrium. And I resent, you know, I resent it, and I convey resentment and judgment toward my partner, who, of course, you know, experiences that sense of, now let's say my wife, on the other hand, has her experience of outside in, right? She has her experience of an understanding of outside in, where for her, she needs her husband to speak and feel toward her in certain ways in order for her to have equilibrium. Now, I'm not suggesting that, you know, I'm not responsible to speak and feel toward my wife in certain ways. And if, and that, you know, I'm not suggesting that it's all on her, like, I'm responsible. Now, it would be helpful for any spouse in any relationship to realize, though, that ultimately I'm not dependent on my spouse thinking and feeling certain ways. But in the case that she does feel that she's dependent on me thinking and feeling certain ways, then in her own way, she's going to, you know, she's going to experience what we call an outside-in phenomenon. And I'm going to look to her just as unsettling and damaging as she looks to me. So we've got these two parties who are living in an understanding that says, I need you to be and do and think in ways that I am and do and think, or otherwise I feel violated, I feel damaged. Now, you can imagine that's not a recipe for a lot of good feeling in a relationship, right? I mean, that's a recipe, you know, the joke that came to me in kind of describing this is like, how many insecure people does it create to create a conflict, you know? Well, the truth is that it really only takes one person to insecure person to create conflict, but the more the merrier, you know? If you have two parties experiencing the insecurity of living in and think and believing that his or her well-being is directly related to the behaviors of his or her partner, that's the definition of insecurity. Like insecurity is I'm dependent on things that I know I don't have control over in order to get the life I want. That's kind of synonymous with insecurity, and that's a recipe for conflict, and God forbid, you know, protracted conflict and hurt. You know, it really can kind of dial up and dial up and dial up. And I think that that's something that is basically what's going on at the root of all conflict, you know. Whereas the opportunity is to kind of look and acknowledge that ultimately it might be the case that my partner or my child or I myself are doing things that are not constructive. But there is a deeper and simpler truth that is always present, that I'm never actually living in an unsafe space. I'm never living in a, what's the word? I'm never living in a space that is volatile or threatening. It's not to say that I'm always having a good mood. This has nothing to do with always having a good mood. This is the truth is that I'm always living in a single simple truth that is subject to a variety of feeling states. It's subject to a variety of experiences because divine energy is showing up moment to moment, and I'm having a whole varied experience of that. If you go back to the metaphor of the child who encounters his or her shadow, right? The toddler who's walking on a blacktop and who sees her shadow, we've watched, or I've shown on occasion, such a toddler literally screaming in terror at the sight of her own shadow, like becoming completely unsettled by it. Now the feeling of suffering of that child is a real feeling. The experience of suffering of that child is a real experience of suffering. But yet what's profound is that even as real and painful is the feeling of that suffering, it was never the case that the child was really in danger. It was only a function of a misunderstanding. There's only one source to that suffering. That's the misunderstanding about what is true about that shadow. And you and I are having those shadow experiences. We get divine energy showing up in our heart that's like a hit of insecure feeling. And we look at that feeling and we kind of associate it with some circumstances out there in the world. It could be our child. It could be our spouse. It could be our colleague. It could be our team, whatever it is. And we think to ourselves, this is a fixed circumstance that is sourcing my pain. And I've tried so many ways and so many times over so many years to adjust or manage or change myself or change that person, and nothing seems to change. And here I go again, being visited by these upset feelings. That's the misunderstanding. And the beauty of this is the realization that I'm not taking away, God forbid, for a moment from the real feeling of suffering, the real feeling of pain that is associated with encountering that shadow, that perception of divine energy of an insecure quality. I don't mean to dismiss that at all. But what I am pointing to is the simple truth that there is nothing in an absolute sense that's real about that actual source of pain. Like we're so close. That child, that toddler there's nothing really inherent to her life experience that is actually a source of suffering. There's so little that needs to shift or to change for her to have a completely different experience. That's what I'm pointing to. That's our experience of conflict, of codependence, of the pain of feeling at odds with someone and the inability to kind of change those differences. It's the well-being that I have is already here. That child, that toddler, is actually fear-free right now. There's nothing real about the source of those fears because it's a shadow. It's purely misunderstanding. That's it. And as we become interested in that truth, and as we are willing to kind of face with a certain honesty and a certain courage the truth about our experience, we are aligning ourselves with our own simplicity. This has nothing to do with a meaningful idea that you can apply, that you can grasp and therefore put it into your... I'm not talking about how to use this idea. I'm simply describing, to the best of my ability, I'm simply describing what is already true about our feelings of suffering in a relationship, of feelings of pain in a relationship, that the truth right now is that there's really no source behind that in an absolute sense. It's purely the misunderstanding we're having about our own perception, about our own shadow, about our own experience of divine energy. So those are my thoughts about how I see this show up in what is so common. You know, So the whole idea of conflict, and it's all this codependency is just a common word for the phenomenon of looking outside to my experience in an experience of a relationship. That's it. And I'm going to now I'm going to unmute folks, and if you have a thought or a question, I would love to hear from you.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi, if no one's going to ask, then can you talk a little bit about what you just talked about combined with the need that Hashem puts in us a feeling of lack. So
wait,
Melissa,
I'm having difficulty hearing you. Your voice is
coming for me. Is this better?
It's a little better.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what you said today combined with that there are times that Hashem wants us to feel a lack because he wants us to pray, he wants us to take a step, he wants us to do something. So he might send us that child that's having a very hard time in school, give us that feeling of, oh, no, I can't, how are we going to handle this? I'm afraid for the kid, I'm this for the, you know what I'm saying? So that we take a step, because without that feeling, we probably wouldn't, in other words, we don't have to go into a depression, but I'm just saying without that sort of feeling, which is saying to us, do something, or don't do something, right? Like, so can you talk about the combination of those?
The do something, don't do something?
No, the fact that we could feel whatever we're feeling, but at the same time, there was a certain sense that Hashem did put in us a feeling of lack. Because, like without Adam feeling a lack for the rain, he wouldn't have prayed for the rain.
Right, yes, that's true. So, yes,
so, I guess
it is
the
case that there is a divine
together.
Wisdom behind the phenomenon of insecure feelings, right? That's part of his creation. That's part of his ongoing, design of the human experiences that we are going, as we say in the Shema, you know, I serve God with both our hearts, and, you know, that's the phenomenon of the Yetzer Hara, the insecure, you know, thought source. I come back to, it's amazing to me, it's absolutely amazing to me how this metaphor never loses its relevance, how fresh it is, no matter how many times I kind of wake up to the truth of it, it still stays fresh, you know, and that's going back to the birth metaphor. There's a reason why our primary choices in this world are likened to our children, right? Our main children in this world are the good choices we make. And that means to say that the choices that we're making are the result of a childbirth experience, right? That's the wisdom of associating our choices with with the idea of offspring, is that that making good choices is the result of a birthing experience. Now, you know,
Hello?
You're fortunate to be a mom, and you went through birth. And, you know, what are you going to do when you're in the process of labor? You know, you're going to... Now, here's what I would describe it as in terms of labor. Like, imagine a woman who's in labor and is experiencing intense pain, and she's thinking to herself, there is no way this pain could be so great unless there's something wrong with me. There's no way this pain could be so great unless there's something from my childhood that's not yet resolved. There's no way this pain could be so great unless it's the case that my husband is missing A, B, C, D, right? Imagine that she's experiencing the pain of labor and she's looking around and associating the pain with those various things, right? So the first step is to see the falsehood behind that, you know, just to acknowledge the lack of truth in those inclinations, which is exactly what's going on with me. When I get hit with a strong surge of, you know, insecure feeling, I'm definitely cast in my, there's a part of me, not always, but definitely it's common that I'm thinking to myself, there's no way, the principles inside out, that's true, but like, this child is really in a state of, you know, problematic stuff, and that's obviously part of the reason why I'm in so much pain. Or, you know, my wife is really unwilling to get on board with common sense, and that's obviously part of the pain I'm in. Yeah, the inside out is true, but come on, there's a real factor here that's not just, you know, inside out. So that's not so simple for me to let go of, you know, like when I'm in that pain and I'm casting about kind of wondering what's going on with my pain, it's no different than the woman in childbirth who's staying as she's in the contraction. This labor is the way it is because, you know, because my husband doesn't have his act together, because my child is not, you know, is defective, because, you know, because my childhood was whatever. That's the first step. And that's really, really, really the main thing, you know, is just being willing to acknowledge the truth and being willing to acknowledge what cannot be the truth.
So if the woman's in childbirth and she doesn't know what she's in, she still has to say, okay, wait, I can't say the pain isn't real. I'm in pain, but let me right. see who could tell me the source of it. Because then she still has to go, she has to push. Like, right? Like, in other words, she has to do something to relieve, just to get the baby out. You know what I'm saying? So she can't just say, oh, I'm in pain, but I, like, once she finds out the source, sometimes there's something to do. That's all I'm saying. In other words, sometimes it is a question, right? Like, you can't, okay, you do have to go talk to the principal. You might have to change a school. You might have to put him on medicine. I'm not saying that we shouldn't see the source. I'm just saying at the same time, it's just that there is sometimes a sense to look for the source. In other words, what is back to what does Hashem want from me? Why is this pain here? So if you know that, if you don't know you're in labor, you would have to, you know, ask around before you get someone to tell you to go to the doctor. So you can't just say, okay, now again, Hashem could give you an insight also. It doesn't even be, you may not have to, you could be, oh, let me go to the doctor. It was, I'll just give you a funny example. I called a friend of mine last year. I forgot why I needed something from her. So we're on the phone, and she tells me that she's so dizzy. And for some reason, I realized right away her equilibrium was off. And I also heard in her voice a fear. So I said to her, your equilibrium's off, and you're not dying. I'm telling you, she thought she was dying. She goes, are you sure? She goes, how'd you know I thought I was dying? I said, I heard your voice. Like, I guess I'm talking to people long enough that I guess I heard in her voice this certain fear. Now, she didn't, for some reason, she was so caught up in the, you know, in the fear of the dizziness that she didn't think to call the doctor. So Hashem sent me to call her that day. I never call her. For whatever reason, I called her that day. Now, she did have to call the doctor now and go get the medicine for equilibrium, which helped her, right? So it wasn't enough to, okay, it's just a thought. Like, in other words, sometimes, yes, but, okay, Hashem, what do you want? And then we do have to kind of wait for that answer. Sometimes it's not just, right, I like, say, insight on demand. Sometimes there is a certain question. And until that answer comes, you know, we are kind of stuck in the feeling. Because sometimes it's not just, right, if the woman doesn't, she doesn't know she's in labor, the labor's not going away. She still has to have the baby. Is this making sense?
Yeah, I just think, I'm not sure. You know, when I hear you, when I hear you speak of, you know, there's, you know, every metaphor kind of has its limits, and I'm not sure if, you know, in terms of, when I hear you speak of the idea of being stuck in labor, I think
you're in it,
and the opportunity of labor is to realize that the pain of labor is just as truthful and wise, it's just as wisdom based as, you know, the moments that the contractions, you know, stop and there's, you know, relief. Like when you sense the truth behind our experience, then we settle into the pain of the labor in a different way. You know, we're still experiencing the pain. It's just that the possibility of the understanding of that—that's again not a conscious or intellectual understanding. There is the Almighty is pointing me toward a deepening experience, and that pain is part of that. I don't, you know, that's how it looks to me. Like, I just have come to appreciate that. I've seen it happen so many times that I've moved. You know, there have been so many times where I feel like I'm giving birth, in the sense that there's this intense, you know, experience of contraction, of, you know, agitation, upset, and then softening down. You know, what I've come to see is that the more respect I've gained of that, I just see that I don't live in the intensity of pain as long. You know, it hurts. It's just that there is a deeper acceptance that is coming, that our soul knows. You know, inside of us, we know there's no being stuck in pain. There's no stuckness in pain. There's pain as one of the very real destinations of our life, as part of the journey. And there's nothing to do to get out of pain. There's no reason to get out of pain. I'm not saying that I'm not disagreeing with you that there are things to do, but it has nothing to do as a response to the pain. There's nothing to do to fix pain. There's nothing to fix about pain. I'm not sure if I'm hearing that in your words. That's what I'm responding to.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree that you can't fix it. I guess I feel like there's a stage one of this knowing that what the source is and whatever. But then I guess I also feel there's a step two, which is just even if the step two is just sitting in it and just realizing, okay, you know, right now there really is nothing to do. But I keep coming back to your lack class, and that's what keeps sticking in my head of, if Hashem's putting a feeling in us of lack, which would be, let's say, the pain, or then there's a step to take. So I think it does keeps me a little stuck because I'm always wondering, okay, what is right? Like, but I feel like that's what I always learned. Or what does Hashem want from me? So I feel like step one, yes, of course, what you're saying. But then I also feel like maybe there is no step two. Maybe I'm confused on the step two.
You're
saying there is a step two. Maybe there. I'm not confused. So that's what I'm. That's why I said, could you talk about the two together? I'm just trying to.
There is you going back to the metaphor. There is a pushing process that happens, right? But
yes.
Tell me, what would you What would you think of pushing in a while you're in a contraction?
What do you mean? What would I think? Or
is that advice that a woman, you know, would give to a woman in labor? Push while you're in a contraction?
Yeah, if you're ready to push, you have to push while you're in a contraction. That's when you push. When you're ready, when it's time, you do push.
Oh, right,
when
the dilation. Right. Okay, yes, of course.
You do cook. You do push. Yes, but at the time when you're not ready.
Right, so you know
that's
what?
That's why we have Lamas and breathing.
Let's pause.
And
I'm not an expert. I'm not as much of an expert on childbirth as I thought.
We have a lot to do during labor.
Right.
We have to get through it.
The metaphor is where there is a, you know, where there's an opening, you know, where the opening is opened enough, right? That's the metaphor, that there's a
right.
point where it makes
time.
Sense to push, but not before
right.
that point, right?
But not before, so you're kind of waiting. That's why I said you can't, it's not
you're
inside
sitting
out
in,
hand.
You're just sitting in the experience.
Right.
And that's
and
not a process that you're managing, you know, that moment
right.
in that pain where you're not clear or you're agitated and you can sense that you're in an agitated state, that you don't see the world in an inside-out way. You can see that you're seeing it outside-in because of your feeling state. There's nothing to do about that. There's nothing to fix about it, and there's nowhere to go.
So that's what I consider as stage one. Then stage two is, let's say, an insight or something where someone says, okay, push.
Yeah, okay, so that's not a stage two that you manage, right? That's a stage two that's a door opens up, a door becomes visible to you. And
that's
that always happens, right? A person
right.
who is willing and interested, I mean, even if a person's not willing and interested, the Almighty shows us new things all the time, even without us acknowledging where and how those new doors are being shown to us, right? That's the beauty of being human, is that we're living in this beautiful this beautiful consciousness or this beautiful system, whether we understand it or not. But certainly it's reliable that there will be new doors that will show up. Our job is to where we see that truth, we become comforted that there's no problem being in this experience of stuck. There's nothing for me to do, you know, like I can be here right now and not need anything other than this moment. And I can, there's not a problem that I'm going to get the idea of what to do. It's not normal that human beings who touch that experience of understanding, it's not normal that they're going to, it is normal that if they don't understand, they're going to do things that could be harmful to themselves and others, right?
Yes.
it is not normal that if they have a glimpse of that understanding, that their pain is just going to go on forever and they're going to act out of destructive manners. The design is that we're moving toward understanding when we are not getting overly involved.
Right. So I think that what I'm hearing is kind of what I was saying, that, you know, in the beginning, I guess, I don't know if you're loving the stage one, stage two metaphor. Maybe I should get off that one and say it differently. But at a certain point, you're kind of not stuck, but sitting in a feeling, and you're waiting, hopefully more patiently than not, for, you know, the idea of either there's something to do or there's something not to do. But in other words, we're not afraid of either one. We're just...
Right. That's all. Yeah, that's right. There's, and in that sense, that's why I'm picking up on, you know, maybe you don't mean this, but that waiting, that word waiting, can suggest that your eyes are looking toward, you know, something beyond this moment. That's all. That's all I'm getting at.
Right.
Is that there's a deep possibility of, there's a possibility of a very deep acceptance of this moment where there really is no other moment. I mean, because that's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
There really is no other moment. There's no other way that reality is created except in this moment from a source beyond us. So when we see that, when we glimpse that, we become liberated from our expectations in a real sense. We become liberated from our kind of desire to anticipate, manage. And if we don't feel that way, if we don't feel liberated, if we feel anticipating, you know, looking to get out of something, well, that's fine also. That's itself, you know, an experience of life that's coming from the divine, right? It's that itself is a type of divine thought, and we can wake up to that.
Hi, Rabbi Harris.
Yes.
Hi. I was wondering about last week's session. You had mentioned that if someone speaks to another in a way that is from a calm place, then there's some sort of likelihood that the receiver will just receive it a lot better. I think we're talking about a teacher and a student. And I was thinking that sounds kind of outside into me. Like, why should it have to matter in what state the speaker is in when they say it? But on the other hand, I know that in our Torah, it says that words that come from the heart enter the heart.
So yes.
I want to know how you reconcile that with, like, outside.
That's a great
in,
question.
Maybe the principles, the principles is out of the scope, and this is where Torah comes in, which I'm happy to accept also. But anyway, I just wanted
no,
to
I think
know.
That they're consistent. I think that that people who talk about the principles of innate health would point to the same understanding as I see it. Here's how I understand it. Let me just restate what I hear your question to be. If we're affirming the idea that our experience is coming from a single simple source at all times, and that's divine energy in this moment, then why should it be that if we're interacting with someone and we're standing in a certain calm understanding, a certain awareness of that truth, why should it be that that would influence someone beyond us? Right? And
yes.
Here's what I would say. I don't think that it's a guarantee in any sense. I don't think that it's not true that if you are living in a calm understanding of this single simple truth, that those around you will be affected automatically. It's normal that they will be, but it's not like literally a button that you can press and then it affects them as if, you know, you're directly changing their consciousness. The way it works, as I understand it, is that because the power of our own simplicity is so profound, right? The existing health and simplicity inside of us is so powerful it's built, it's inbuilt to us, right? It's already present in us, that simplicity. It's so powerful. We lose track of it because of our misunderstanding, right? Our misunderstanding about how the world works, our subtle but an innocent but real misunderstanding that points us to look toward away from truth. It's my circumstances, it's my classmates, it's my siblings, that they're the sources of my experience. That allows us to lose sight of that simplicity, but it's a relatively superficial misunderstanding. You know, the simplicity is right there, and it's so real. So when that child comes into contact with someone who has seen the simplicity of life, is living in an awareness of that divine source, then it's normal that divine source, that simplicity in the child, will become like titillated almost, like it'll be touched a little bit. It's like the idea of a there's a couple metaphors to point to this. One is the idea of two different string instruments. If two string instruments are tuned, and you pluck the string of one, what's fascinating is that the other string instrument starts to vibrate with that same on that same key. It's as if you plucked the other one as well. How did that happen? You didn't physically do anything. Doesn't matter, because they're designed in a similar, because they operate in the same way and their design is identical, then there's a resonance between them. There's an absolute resonance between them. My soul and the soul of a child that is in my, you know, that I interact with, we're also in resonance with one another, so that when I operate on a simple frequency, there's something about that frequency that starts to touch them. Now, I might not see it in that moment. The child may not see it in that moment, but something does resonate with them, because that's just the design of the human experience, is that God designed our souls, that we're basically part of one energy. You know, our souls are part of one energy, and we resonate. Another metaphor to express this is the metaphor of the water, that you know, my heart is like water, in that when someone looks at my heart, if my heart is still, they see a still image of themselves. And if my heart is agitated, if I feel troubled and dependent on all kinds of circumstances and feeling, you know, insecure in that way, if my heart is agitated and they look at me, they will see their own. They'll see their own agitated self. It doesn't mean that they're stuck living that way. There's still a free. There's still a capacity for free will there, but they will be presented with an image of their own self in me. So that's why when my waters are still, and I interact with someone, I don't know where, when, and how, but it for sure is the case that they come into contact with not my stillness alone, with their stillness. And that's going to touch them. There's still free will, so they still have the choice to listen and tune into it, but it for sure is the case that they have an encounter with their stillness. And because of the profound quality of that stillness that's already present, there's a good chance that they're going to be interested in that. They're going to get a hit of that in a way that it's going to, you know, it's something's going to happen.
Wow, that is really neat. I love those muscles. It's really just that something resonates in the other person. They find either they see a stillness of them, and it's always nice to see a stillness for some reason, maybe because that's like Hashem. And they see something in them that they like to, I guess, have brought out more, that they see in the other person. Is that like what you mean?
Yeah. They'll taste a feeling of their own soul vibrating. They'll taste a feeling of their own soul's reflection. That doesn't mean they understand it. Doesn't mean they know anything about it. Doesn't mean that they're conscious of it. But they'll get a feeling of their own soul's resonance. And that's going to touch them. You know, the Song of Songs, it says, Ani Yishena Velibi Er. I'm asleep, but my heart is awake. That's the truth of what a human being is. A person is living with this heart, this internal connection to the divine source that is awake. It's pumping, it's beating, it's vibrating and pulsing with divine understanding at all times. But I'm asleep, right? My conscious personal mind is capable of being asleep to the reality and the truth of my own inner reality. But it's very real. It is superficial. My sleepiness, is superficial relative to the truth of this spiritual awakeness.
Wow, that's really neat.
And that's good news for us if we're looking to be of help to people. It's not going to come, through kind of giving them direct rebuke or correction necessarily. It's going to work through, coming to trust in, as we come to trust in and gain acceptance of our experience of life and how there's a divine source behind it, and we're accepting of that, and there's a certain lack of a need to run away, a lack of a need to manage and fight our experience. As we gain trust in and acceptance of our own simple truth, then we become less bothered by someone's volatility outside of us. This is what I spoke about when I was talking about the memoir of that parent whose child was going through this horrific substance abuse, Tremendous, I don't, God forbid, have any, judgment toward the two of them, but it was so clear that there was this painful, painful codependence. This one felt totally at their mercy, the child felt totally at the mercy of his own fearful feelings. It was absolutely compelling information. His fearful feelings were a description of something absolutely real about him and about the world. He is unstable. He is vulnerable to destructive choices. He is a self-destructive person. That was, to him, the presence of fearful feelings showing up in his heart of feelings that I can't manage my life, feelings of hopelessness or self-judgment. Those feelings were absolutely descriptive to him of something real about himself in the world. And he was really, really vulnerable to, the enticement of those of that worldview. And as a result, he would become lost in despair, the pain would overwhelm, and he would say, look, if I can't get relief in a life that I know, that in a life that I'm not good at, I might as well get some relief in a life that I know. Of course, it's, living under a bridge and robbing people, but at least there's some relief there, And so he's in that volatile experience. And then the parent is, totally living in a code, which, again, I can't even begin to utter, the pain and the feeling of compassion that I can feel toward the father who's, feeling absolutely dependent and vulnerable to his child's behavior. Like, I can't live a life if you're going up and down like this. My life is, if you're in a not good place, then I am hostage. And so I have this desire to have compassion toward you, but I have so much resentment toward you because the fact that you can't get your life together means that my life cannot be together. And so then the child feels that conditional kind of expression of love. It's just like it's a painful loop that they're living in. Yeah.
What's neat to know about what we were just talking about is that, I'm thinking of a specific person who I just felt so gravitated to, and it was like magic for some reason. They were just so present and kind, and they were just such a special person. I couldn't put my finger on why, but now that you say these analogies, it's kind of like, oh, that's cool. Like, maybe it's because something in them, like, resonated and something in me. And it's not like it was outside in and, like, I need this person to be around so that I could be in a good mood, or I need this person to calm me. It's like the reason why I felt so titillated by them is because they were, like, awakening something in me that was there.
If they're, to the extent that they're living in some recognition of a simple truth, it can be of help to you in sensing that same truth. Now, of course, the ultimate goal is to see it for ourselves, but there's a value in having teachers and friends and others with whom we can explore and kind of resonate this with. I forgot to mention at the beginning of this talk, but I wanted to just dedicate the today's conversation, Le'ilui Nishmas, for the elevation of the soul of my grandmother, my mother's mother, who my mother is on this call. My mother's mother was a special, special bubby, and a special mother, and a special person. Her name was Leah Bas Chaim Nachum Halevi, and today is her yahrzeit. And so may the learning that we do and the understanding that we gain and the efforts we put forth, it all should be a source of elevation to her soul. She was a precious, precious bubby, and I miss her. And I have to stop now. Thank you so much for being on the call. Have a wonderful Shabbos and a wonderful week. And, Mom, thanks for being on the call with me.